Fashion, food, film, and music, some of our greatest loves in life. Welcome to Seems to Me with Sibylline Sariano and Steve Ricardo.
Hello.
Hey, hey. What is up?
So apparently you're a little bit tired because what have you been doing all week?
Oh, man. I have been opening up an art gallery, and I have never been an art gallerist in my life.
Art gallerist? I didn't even know that was a term. I like that. Art gallerist.
A gallerist. That's what they call people who own art galleries. So, Sibylline, the art gallery is now open.
Yes, it is.
At 460 C Harrison Avenue in the heart of the SOA Art District. And holy cow, I'm an art gallerist.
That is quite the gallery, too, if I might say so myself.
You.
I was there at the matinee the opening. It was fantastic.
So
Jean Seriano's art. It's called Crowd Me, I'm Alone, right?
Crowd Me, I'm Alone.
Loved
is the...
it.
Starting off exhibits for representing my father as a artist, contemporary abstract artist. He's incredible. He's been painting since the 60s straight through to 2019. And we have an incredible display of his artwork up at my new art gallery.
I checked it all out, too. It was a lot of fun hanging
out.
We had a great time. We had to keep it limited with the amount of people that were in there, but it was fun. And we had the Violent Cat in the matinee playing violin. She was unbelievable.
Incredible.
She played
such a talent.
Beatles, Zeppelin. Like, she could play anything. She had this hollow body Yamaha violin, and she was blowing my mind.
She's really outstanding. Standing, really talented young woman, and she. What was the Led Zeppelin song that she played that I loved?
Over the Hills and Far Away. I don't remember.
She played some
cool Beatles songs too.
Yeah. It,
people from other galleries were coming in because they're like, "Who's that?" You know.
So here's the thing that totally surprises me. Everybody thinks it is so unusual to have live music in an art gallery, and I'm like, this is what I'm all about. I'm all about having really cool events in my art gallery. I love events. I love hosting. I'm the hostess with the mostest. And
Yes, you are.
To me, it's about having live music. So we had Violin Cat in the morning, in the matinee, as you say. And we had Mark Femino in the evening. He played straight for 4 hours,
wow.
Steve. 4 hours. He told me his hand was like totally cramped at the end of the night. His new album is Femi La Bouche.
We're using his song as our intro song.
We are.
Harborside.
The Harborside, which is...
The Harborside.
I believe it is, right? The Harborside. It's a ode to all the nights he played at the Harborside in Boston. And his album is Femi La Bouche. And it's a really great, incredible work of art.
Well, I think you did a fantastic job putting the whole thing together. You had the eclectic freelance violinist, as she calls herself, and then you had the funky Mark Femino at the nighttime show.
Yeah, he played acoustic finger picking. He played me Prince, and he just played some of my great, my favorite artists as well. So it was really special, a special day, weekend. I felt the love. I had so much support come out. My Syracuse girls. I went to Syracuse
University.
I knew
we were going to talk about Syracuse.
I mean, I bleed orange, dude. We have to talk about Syracuse.
Your father was really cool, too. You could tell he's an old school.
Huh?
He used to hang out with Warhol, right?
Warhol,
wow.
Herring.
That is
all
cool.
All those guys. He was rolling in the 60s, 70s, 80s in Manhattan in the art scene.
And he was dressed
He
was dressed very stylishly. Did his daughter have anything to do with that?
Well, I had a whole nother outfit he was supposed to wear, and he didn't show up in it. So I had to send my mother to the hotel to change him. But that was his choice. Absolutely. He had like a rainbow kind of sweater on.
And he was smiling the whole time. I got some photos with him.
My father has a zest for life that is infectious, and his laugh is also just, you know, super dynamic and one of a kind. He's one of a kind. We've had our ups and downs in life, but
we all do.
You know, it was really such a pleasure to be able to do this for my father and for, you know, the breadth of work, to showcase the breadth of work he's done. So I'm honored to be able to do it.
And that space is fantastic.
Thank you. I've
never been over there. It's in the south end of Boston. Very artsy over there.
Bunch of galleries and working artists.
Give me the geography on that, or give the audience, because I'm not really...
There are two main buildings that represent the SOA Art District, 450 Harrison and 460 Harrison. 450 is predominantly, well, from my understanding, it's all working artists. In order to have a studio or a space in that building, you have to be actually a working artist that's painting and representing yourself. Then there is a separation of a little walkway called Thayer Street.
Oh, yeah. It used to be the famous rock lofts used to be down there old day. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know
that. The Thayer Street lofts were famous for the underground Boston rock scene back in the 90s,
Whoa.
80s, 90s. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I just got the chills. That's awesome.
Yeah. You're in a great neighborhood. I never really spent much time over there, but I really liked it.
It's changed a lot. Like, it's evolved. It's evolved. You know, good, bad, or ugly, depending on which way you look at it. You know, Pine Street Inn is still right there. There's still a little, you know, little of this, little of that walking around. But it's gentrified and it's, you know, huge, amazing lofts and apartments that are going up.
You
know. I feel really lucky. I feel really lucky to have. I mean, the only reason why space was even available was because of COVID. And also there had been a water main break that cleared out a couple people out of the building, unfortunately for them. But fortunately for me,
for you.
I was able to land a 1,500
square
foot
art gallery.
The same
thing happened in the building we're in, actually. We're down at New Alliance in Somerville. The same thing, I think, happened here. They had a flood down here. That's how you get buildings. You wait till they flood out, and then you move in.
Right. There you go, right?
So by the time people hear this, it's going to be well after Easter. But yesterday was Easter. Mm-hmm. Did you have a good Easter?
Well, I guess I had a quiet Easter. I took a nap, which I never do. But
I felt crappy afterwards.
Yes.
Probably that's what happens to me when I take a nap.
Oh, I was so lethargic. But I have a little 8.5-year-old daughter named Josie, and she loves all holidays. And we did a little Easter egg hunt, Easter basket. But I didn't get to have my, you know, standard usual Easter dinner, which is kind of always been a big deal.
Neither did I.
You didn't. What was?
Well,
what were you supposed to do?
I think I, you know, as you know, I recently was put on a gluten-free diet.
Yes, you have.
So I've had gluten-free pizza like about five times in the last 2 weeks because I don't know what to eat. It's really frustrating.
And are you buying frozen gluten-free pizza?
Is that bad?
We can talk about. No. I mean, listen,
it's brown rice, right?
It's brown rice or cauliflower, depending on, and sometimes corn flour. What people have to really worry about and watch out is some of the biggest allergies that you can be affected by is wheat, corn.
Yeah, I can't eat wheat anymore.
But corn. So here's the deal. So corn is in a lot of the things that are gluten-free now. I actually have an issue with corn as well. So I'm gluten-free because of the wheat, and I also have to watch out for corn. So I'm excited to kind of share with you all my experience in
Dr.
the world.
Dr. Seriano.
I know. Apparently, I'm Dr. Gluten-Free Seriano here.
It's funny that we're both on a gluten-free diet. It's the gluten-free podcast.
Welcome to old age.
This is new for me, though. It's only been 3 weeks. I also quit drinking, and I was like averaging a bottle of red wine a day since the pandemic started, like a lot of people, from what I understand. But I feel pretty good. I mean, I feel like, you know, I feel like it's working.
Hey, listen, I mean, whatever works. I kind of went the opposite direction. I decided I was damned if I was going to gain the COVID-19, as everybody calls it. And I focused on exercise. I did a lot of virtual workouts with my gym, and
good for you.
I didn't really drink. We had one Zoom get together with my high school friends, and I was like, I'm in the mood for a rum and coke. I'm gonna get a rum and hold on. on, girls. I'm going to make myself a rum and coke. Next thing I knew, and I was on an empty stomach. Next thing I know, I had 5 rum and cokes. I kid you not.
5?
Yes.
That would do 4 to 5 damage to me.
Awful. It was awful. I was hugging the porcelain god. No joke.
Oh, no. I'm embarrassed. I haven't been there in a while.
Yeah, it was bad. My girlfriends, I had to, like, actually say, hold on, I'm coming back. And they were like, Sib? I could hear them in the other room. Are you okay, Sib? I'm like, oh, God.
I thought no one was allowed to call
you Sib.
They're
allowed to call me Sib, but not anybody else.
I'm not calling you that.
No. They're my high school friends.
So you mentioned a porcelain experience, and this is a good segue because we're going to talk about your restaurant that you love that has the great tequila drinks. And my last porcelain experience was from tequila.
Was from tequila.
It was many years ago.
Interesting. Okay. What kind of tequila? That's
I don't know the difference between one or the other. I was at a Mexican restaurant. It happened actually not too far from where we are now in Cambridge.
All right. Let's talk about tequilas then, because there is a vast difference between tequilas, and I am a tequila girl.
If you drink that Sammy Hagar tequila,
the Cabo Wabo, it's okay. It's all right. It's not the best. My personal favorite is a tequila called Siete Leguas, and it is a 7 languages. That's translated to 7 languages. It's got a cow on the front with a big 7, which is my lucky number. It is very oaky, Steve.
Oaky
tequila is the way to go. So they barrel it in oak barrel or
really?
that's
an
called.
Education this is.
Yeah, so I learned many moons ago we were in San Diego and we went to a tequila bar and I wanted
to
know.
You went to Tijuana right across the border? That's what I used to do when I was in San Diego.
I did back in the day when I probably shouldn't have gone. But yes.
Did you live in California too?
I did.
Oh, so did. Well, you know, I lived in LA for a long time. Where did you live?
We were in Santa Monica on Arizona.
It's nice over there.
Arizona.
That's where Whitey Bulger was hanging out.
I know. I swear to you, I saw him one day.
I did in a sports bar. There was a Boston sports bar in Santa Monica that I went to when I lived out there in 2006.
Okay.
And there were all these old dudes from Boston there. Whitey was probably hanging out there.
I was there in 96. I moved out there
right
after college.
I was in 96 too, actually.
I love California.
Yeah,
I'm a California
too.
Girl.
Me
for
too.
Sure. What I'm doing here in Boston. You know, come
same,
on now.
Same.
I'm sorry, Bostonians, but I'm a warm weather summer girl, you know.
I'm sorry.
Let's go back to tequila because I wanted to talk about my favorite. I have several favorite restaurants here in Boston, but my absolute favorite restaurant in Boston is in the South End. So I want to plug the South End, and it's Toro, one of Ken Oranger's restaurants. He's opened a number of them now. But, man, it is a tapas Spanish restaurant. It's sexy. It's small. You can never get a table in there. I love sitting at the bar there. And I discovered a drink there called La Verdad y Amor. And it's a hibiscus-infused tequila.
Ooh.
And they do a ginger
sugar rim. A healthy tequila?
Rim.
A what sugar rim?
A ginger sugar rim. So it's got a spice to it.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, once you drink one of these, you can't stop drinking them, unfortunately. So, you know, hangovers do catch up to you on that one. But and the food there is phenomenal. They have these shrimp. It's like a garlic shrimp, but it's got a beautiful orange color to it. Really phenomenal food. Just tapas. They have paella. You name it. It's by far, for me, it's one of my favorite experiences in Boston to go sit at the bar there.
I got to check that place out.
If
they've been
there.
Okay during the pandemic?
Well, I have tried to go a couple times, and because they're doing such a limited seating, I haven't been able to get in. So maybe if this is a plug for them, they'll invite us to come in and
introduce
you
shrimp.
To the food.
That's part of a gluten-free diet, right?
Oh, there's just so much more on the menu. Potatoes bravas. I mean, you name it. A tortilla. The tortilla espanol. It's like egg, potato, and a few other ingredients, but it's just a tortilla. It's delightful.
You're like so that's me. You get all orgasmic when you talk about food. I'm the same way. Oh, I love food.
That's why we're doing this. Food, yes. Fashion, film, music. Those are the four things that make me orgasmic. So
I made you go and watch Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for a second time because I've seen it three times. You have some very interesting observations about this amazing Quentin Tarantino 2019 film. Yeah. You were talking about the colors.
Yeah, so I think for me, when I watch a movie, the first thing that grabs me is the color in the film and the cinematography and the music. You know, so it's those three things that are really just what jump out and what I mean, I'm such a visual person, right? One of the things I noticed right away the first time I saw it and one of the things I noticed right away the second time I saw it was the usage of his color. And right away I'm like, oh my God, it's the yellow. It's the yellow that I've been drawn to this whole year. It's like this kind of ochre yellow, sunshine yellow, cadmium yellow. And it's so vibrant in the film. And then it's a juxtaposition to the red as well, like that beautiful, deep, bright. It's deep and yet bright at the same time. I can talk color for days, but
I can tell.
You know, I don't
know. I'm
gonna
have to go back for a fourth time
and
check out the colors.
You are. I'm telling you, it. There's a scene where Al Pacino's sitting there at the restaurant.
Musso and Franks in Hollywood.
Exactly, talking to Leonardo DiCaprio's character,
Rick Dalton.
Thank you. And he's got this red pocket square, and right behind him is this woman wearing a red jacket, and it's all I could see when they're like doing that.
Really?
Scene. Yeah. But then Pacino is, I mean, the cast in this film.
Oh, my God. Fantastic.
Right?
Brad Pitt got the Oscar out of all of them. But Margot Robbie playing Sharon Tate. Oh, fantastic.
She is gorgeous. Both of them. They could park their boots under my bed and I wouldn't turn
Brad
them
away. Brad Pitt and Margot Robbie?
Yeah, why not?
That would be a fun night.
Oh, my God.
I would just enjoy watching.
Oh, God. Anyway, Brad Pitt. So there's so many scenes where he's wearing the yellow. He's got a yellow Hawaiian shirt one point. He's got a yellow T-shirt at one point. Kurt Russell is like
Kurt
telling him
Russell's
how much he hates him.
In the movie. Everyone's in that film.
And then, wait, his trailer is also all yellow. And then Margot walks into the awesome party at that pool party, dance party scene, and she's got the most phenomenal
at the Playboy Mansion.
Exactly, right. That's right. It was the Playboy Mansion.
Yeah, she was dancing with Michelle Phillips and Mama Cass Elliot. Boy, I'm telling you, Tarantino's imagination is just like, it seems so real. If only the ending was real, right?
Right, exactly. Man, I mean, he covers so much in the movie, too. You've got the downward spiral of Leonardo DiCaprio's, you know, having a midlife crisis in his career, right? Then you've got the Sharon Tate story. Then you've got the Brad Pitt story and his whole scene with the whole hippie. What was that supposed to be? Was that the Manson crew?
Yeah, that was the whole Manson
okay.
family.
Okay.
You know, apparently Brad Pitt's character, and I can't remember his name.
Cliff.
Cliff killed his wife, apparently. They kept, hinting that he did. And they only showed him possibly killing his wife, which is funny because Quentin Tarantino likes to show the violence. There were some very violent scenes that I had to turn away from.
Mm-hmm. Even when Brad Pitt's beating the crap out of that kid.
Yeah, that was
his tire.
Whoa.
Oof, that was rough.
One of the Manson family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was hard to watch. And the ending, I'm sorry if someone has not seen this film because we're probably ruining it for them right now. Should I talk about the soundtrack a little bit?
Yes, please.
I heard on an interview that Quentin Tarantino has been known to make mixtapes up to like 6 months before making a movie in order to define the musical atmosphere of the film, which this one is depicted in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
He really nailed it in Jackie Brown when he came up with Bobby Womack and the Delphonics, and he had that great soul, like 60s, 70s soul soundtrack. In this one, he did the same thing. And I loved it when Margot Robbie's character, Sharon Tate, is listening to Paul Revere and the Raiders. And then I looked at the soundtrack. There's like four Paul Revere and the Raiders songs
so clearly
in the film.
That's what was speaking to him, huh?
Yeah, and he also included Rambling Man by the Bob Seger System, Hush by Deep Purple, which was their first real hit, and a Jose Feliciano version of California Dreaming.
Mm.
So he drove around in his car for like 6 months with his mixtape. He doesn't listen to streaming stations.
So he's like old school mixtape.
He's very old school.
Just like we are, right?
And apparently he's got an enormous record collection. I mean, what is there not to
like
about
Quentin Tarantino?
Clearly he loves music.
I mean, the soundtrack of Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, I mean, some of the best soundtracks there is, right? I mean, there are.
And Jackie Brown, like
right.
I mentioned.
Right.
Mean, yeah, the music was prevalent. It's always prevalent in his films.
I caught the one scene where he's playing Mrs. Robinson.
Oh, yes.
What's your take on that?
Well, I love the song. I've always loved the song. I even like when the Lemonheads did a cover of the song, and that ended up in a few films.
Yeah,
you
love
know?
That. Love that.
He's really knows his music.
But in that moment when he's playing Mrs. Robinson, to me, it's a take on what Mrs. Robinson was all about, right? Like the older woman, the younger man, but it's a flip-flop.
Flip, yes.
So he's playing with that. And it's just a little teeny clip of it. It's like barely even most, you know, it's a quarter of the song. But I caught it because I was like, oh, he's making that reference to, you know, Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski.
Yes.
And that marriage lasted about a year from what I read.
Well,
maybe
no,
a year
well,
or two.
It ended because of her death, basically.
But he was already
well,
doing
he was
some
probably,
shady stuff.
When
he
wasn't he doing
down.
Shady things? Mm. When he made Rosemary's Baby, he was shady.
Mm.
I don't know. Polanski, that's a whole nother.
Yeah,
we could go down that road sometime. But
I'd have to do a little more research.
I don't know
on him.
If we want to go down that road.
Well, so there's a couple of things that I noticed about the film. First of all, in the very first scene with Rick Dalton, he looks like James Dean to me. I mean, he really is a rep. I mean,
yeah.
He's representing James Dean in that scene and that look.
James Dean meets Steve McQueen.
Right. Right, absolutely.
I love Steve McQueen, by the way.
And I love James Dean. I mean, I had posters of James Dean and Marilyn Monroe on my bedroom wall in
high
school.
Oh, I know you love Marilyn Monroe.
Yes, my muse. And I think Margot Robbie
she was fabulous.
Which one?
Margot Robbie.
Yeah,
was
I was going to say, are we talking about Marilyn or Margot?
The way she dressed and everything, you know, the way
that one outfit where she comes out of the door and they're on their way to the mansion, to the Playboy mansion, and she's got on a floor length snakeskin jacket, like leather jacket. And they get in that car. First of all, can we talk about the vintage cars in the movie? Like, I'm a big vintage car
I love
girl.
How we pay attention to different things in a film.
Oh, yeah.
The cars were great. The Cadillac was what they drove around in, right?
Oh, no.
Brad
mean
Pitt
Brad
drove
Pitt.
Him around in the Cadillac. But Brad Pitt had a little Cadillac? Sports car.
Oh, yeah. I loved his little, like, loud sports car. But then also Roman Polanski
he had a sports
Sharon
car
Tate,
too.
And they're like, you know, driving around in this, and just the filming of that when they're going down the Hollywood Hills and
Laurel
I mean,
Canyon. Yeah, Laurel Canyon.
Quentin Tarantino is. So there's one scene where they refer to the guy as the Heavy. And I was like, you know what, I'm going to look, should I look it up or should I ask Steve what the Heavy means?
Oh
so
my,
he's
I don't
referring
even know what
to like,
you're talking about.
Well, when he's talking about the demise of his character and how he's going to be starting to play the Heavy. And I guess the Heavy was like a role that was like the has-been.
Oh, the bad. Well, he ended up playing a bad guy when he met that young actress.
Yes.
That's my favorite scene when she goes, that was the best acting I've ever seen in my life. I love that girl. The young, I don't know her name or
and
anything.
And she was 8 years old, supposedly.
And Dalton was like really depressed at that time because he screwed up that scene. And then he went to his trailer and destroyed his trailer.
He shows up like hungover from all Get Out. And
he
just
partied hard.
Yeah, like you can tell he's just like wallowing in his own misery about his career. And then he meets her and she kind of changes every, like, she kind of.
That was a turning point for him.
Yeah, yeah.
But then he had to go and do the spaghetti westerns in Italy. But he ended up coming home with a beautiful wife.
I was going to say, that wasn't so shabby.
He did pretty good.
Right?
I'd
like to go shoot some westerns in Italy.
The way Tarantino invented an actor, and there's even a Wikipedia page for Rick Dalton now, because a lot of people thought there was really a Rick Dalton.
Right. I mean, Mr. Pink, Mr. White. I mean, all those
guys.
He
does that in all his films,
I mean, what's Uma Thurman's character's name in Pulp Fiction? I mean, they're iconic.
He does a lot of research about things that actually don't make it in the film so that he actually creates a whole character that you believe exists.
And he has so many layers to these films, so many layers. I mean, you caught the swastika stuff, right? And all the Nazi stuff. I mean, there's that scene where he opens it up. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you noticed this, but he opens up the curtains, the red curtains.
Yeah.
And he looks down and he's looking at the Nazis through the fence, through the little, I don't know, fence on the balcony. And all you see are swastikas in the fence.
Yeah.
In the little balcony. But then I actually rewound. I mean, I went back several times to see when they shoot up and they show you the balcony up. You don't see swastikas, but you see it when you look down into that scene.
I am going to have to watch this film for a fourth time. But that's not unusual for me. You know, I've seen two films 25 times each. You'd never guess, so I'll tell you. Almost Famous.
Oh,
I've watched the director's cut of that
25
times.
That
and then again. Gus Van Sant's brilliant drugstore cowboy with Matt Dillon. I've watched that.
And we're
going to
cover both
times.
Of those on this podcast.
Two of my
for
favorite
sure.
films ever.
Yeah, me
and
too.
Then after that, it's a bunch of Pacino films. Dog Day Afternoon, Serpico, Godfather, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So there's another part where Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate are on their way home, and they're waiting at their gate to get in. Rick Dalton and Cliff are in the car.
Yes, I know.
And Rick's like, oh, my God, that's her. You know, that's him. He like, changes
his attitude. He wasn't really paying attention to Sharon Tate. He was more enthralled by the fact that he lived next door to Roman Polanski. And he's, like, this actor who's on his way down, and Polanski's on his way up. And he's living in the mansion next door.
Yeah, he's driving up the hill. But there's a commercial playing on the radio in this scene, and I rewound it several times to listen to it. It's a commercial for cologne. Remember how I wanted to talk about cologne? So it's a commercial for cologne, and it says, there's only 4 cents that matter in this world, men's cologne, something like that. And I was like, I wanted to know more. I wanted to know, what are the 4 cents that only matter? But I have always said that a man in cologne is
I'm getting
essential.
0 points right now because I never wear cologne.
Listen,
do I need
guys,
to wear Old Spice for the next episode
anything,
of our show?
Anything's
here?
Better than nothing. Old Spice works.
Seems
you know.
To me, sponsored by Old Spice.
Oh, God. Or Aqua Velva.
Aqua. Ugh, oh, my
no,
God.
No, actually, it's not bad. It's not bad.
Oh, but, it's horrible.
I always appreciated that one. Aramis.
I use the mango butter from the Body Shop. That's what I like, you know, exploring my feminine side.
Yeah, I was
going
to say, that's a little feminine, but that's okay. Well, Tom Ford, to me, does the best job of a unisex product. He does cologne that he feels that men can wear his cologne perfume and women can wear the cologne and the perfume. And I actually use
Tom Ford.
Tom Ford, yeah, the man that, you know, basically brought Gucci to another level in these last, you know.
This is something I know nothing about, and that's why you're the queen of fashion.
Yeah.
We never gave up. We were supposed to do our backgrounds for our audience so they would know who we were when we started. And here we are deep into it, and we didn't. Well, why don't we talk about your famous background.
So, ever since I was about 7 years old, I wanted to be a fashion designer. Both my parents are artists. Both of them met in New York City doing printmaking in Manhattan. I was born in Manhattan.
Wow.
Yeah, I have a really unique background. I went to a very small private school that was called Newark Center for Creative Learning. It was run by a bunch of hippies. I was there from kindergarten through eighth grade.
That sounds awesome.
I am who I am because of that school, for sure, because there was a lot of stuff going on between my parents at that time, and that was my family. I got to learn how to, you know, do pottery making and acting and singing and playing music and art and you name it. So, and then I went to Syracuse University, and after that, I...
And you weren't a journalism major.
I was not.
Like everyone I've ever met from Syracuse was a journalism major.
For sure.
Or they played for Jim Boeheim or whatever his name is.
Yeah, Boeheim.
Sorry, I knew I would screw that up.
And lacrosse, the Gates brothers. I mean, we were, you know, there was a, I chose Syracuse over an art school because...
What was your major?
I was a fashion design major.
Oh, duh.
Yeah, fashion, and I studied French and business. But, you know, I made a big decision at that point in my life because I wanted the college experience. I wanted the college education. And, you know, most of the fashion schools are two-year programs. I mean, FIT and Parsons and all those guys, you're not meeting people and doing the Greek system or, you know, going to a dorm or maybe a dorm, yes, of course, but you don't have a quad and a campus. Where did you go to college?
I went to Framingham State University right here in Massachusetts. Well, I actually went to Quinn Sigerman Community College for 2 years. I was not a good student. I went to Framingham because I knew I could get on their radio station there.
Oh, okay.
Because trying to go to Emerson or BU, I didn't have the grades, and I never would have – well, I probably would have been able to weasel my way into the radio station. But at Framingham State, WDJM, I became the music director because I knew
cool.
I would come – because I've always been, like, hardcore with music, you know.
And was that something that you'd say you also were born with? I mean, just that love of music?
When I was young, I was watching the Monkees and the Banana Splits and the Partridge Family. That's where I got my music. And then when I heard Penny Lane, the single by the Beatles with Strawberry Fields Forever, the flip side, that's when I became really interested in, like, the dark side. And then, of course, growing up in Mass with Aerosmith, Dream On, out when you're a kid, it's like, you can't listen to that. They're on drugs, you know. Parents didn't want you to listen to that. But we always found a way to find the evil music.
Wait, so what's the dark side of what you were just referring to?
Well, Aerosmith, did you ever see what they looked like back then? They were
hardcore drug
addicts.
What was the dark side of the Beatles?
The Beatles, I figured out at a very young age the whole Paul McCartney is dead thing. Where they came up with all these clues that Paul McCartney was dead. And plus John Lennon coming out and saying that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus Christ. That was pretty dark when you grew up in a Catholic family in Massachusetts, you know. But my parents never stopped me from listening to music. They encouraged it.
Yeah,
my mother was in the Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass, which ironically, I ended up working for A&M Records. You know, Herb Albert's the A in A&M. Fast-forwarding.
Okay.
We didn't finish your fashion career,
well, that's
though.
That's okay.
We jumped to me.
It's all right. I love this part of it because music was a big piece of my life, too. I don't really know if my mom was all that into music, although she said she was. My dad was always listening to classical. And also, like, I made sure I played Buena Vista Social Club the other day on Saturday. Big fan of Spanish and that sort of influence. What's the dance that my dad loved to do? Not the tango, but the cha-cha. Maybe the cha-cha. He dated a woman for 35 years. It was his muse. And she was very cultural. Not that my father isn't, because he certainly is. But anyway, so my father used to walk me up and down Madison Avenue, Fifth Avenue.
Wow.
He would take me into all the fashion icons, you know, Armani, Chanel. Oh, and I would look up at their logos and I would just like imagine my name in lights. Like I wanted to be a famous fashion designer. And I finally went out on my own at 27 here and opened up my own boutique with my own line of clothing after having worked for Sigrid Olsen, Calvin Klein, Emmanuel Ungaro. I did Richard Tyler out in L.A. I mean, I've worked for a lot of some heavy hitters, I should say. And I just, it was time for me to try it on my own. And I felt like if I was in Manhattan, I'd be a little fish in a big ocean, and if I was doing it in Boston, I'd be a big fish in a little ocean. And that was kind of my reason for picking Boston to launch it.
And every day when I walked down from Teal Square to Davis Square, I would walk by Cibeline the Boutique.
Well, yeah,
and I eventually walked in.
Yeah, and Steve and I became friends that way. We just started.
You designed dresses for the lead singer of one of my bands, The Charms,
L.E.V.
The two biggest shows the band ever played, she wore your dresses.
It was so
the,
cool.
Underground Garage Festival in front of 20,000 people in New York, and when they were live on ESPN on New Year's Eve, opening for the New York Dolls.
I got to tell you, that was a dream for me. It was a dream come true because
I could see those dresses. One was kind of pink, and it had like, and the other was sparkly. It had all this gold spark. I remember the dresses. Isn't that amazing?
You know, she, again,
she wore it well.
For me,
she wore them well.
She did, absolutely, and she's a rock. She's such a rocker, rock chick extraordinaire. And for me, it was truly an honor. I mean, that you guys let me do that. I felt humbled because
we were honored to have the great Cibeline.
I really like my goal in life is to dress musicians. And I never knew that until kind of meeting you guys. But it like made something come alive for me, like to see your designs on a musician on stage. That's a big deal.
Yeah,
we love that. You know?
I sent other people down there to your store as well because I thought your work was just phenomenal. You even dressed me a few times. I ended up getting a few things, but I'm wearing a button-down shirt today, which I usually don't
wear
button-down
shirt. I like it.
I got this in a Goodwill store. Goodwill.
Well, yeah. Hey, I get things at Goodwill. Let me tell you.
Goodwill's good. I get
love
Frank's.
The one right here in Somerville.
Yeah,
right in Davis.
You know, I do art too, and I go to Goodwill looking for frames to frame up my art and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we got a really good segue to wrap this thing up, but you went from Davis Square and you opened the store in Charles Street in Boston,
right? So in 2008, an opportunity came my way. One of my clients was like, "I want to get you on Charles Street," and she found me a space. It was incredible. I felt really, blessed to have that happen. And it took me to the big leagues, to be in Boston on Charles Street.
Yeah, that store was fabulous.
I had a global customer at that point. I mean, global. I had women coming in from Switzerland and Germany.
It's a ritzy neighborhood.
I will tell this little fun story because this was my first weekend open. And, in Davis Square, I'd have somebody come in and they'd see my $200 dress and they'd think about it and they'd dream about it and they'd come in and visit it. And it would take them about a month to make that purchase, okay? So I had this woman come in. She was like a whirlwind. She was a commercial real estate agent. And she's like, oh, my God, these things are amazing. Are these all your designs? Oh, my God, blah, 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 blah. She's like trying things on. She's running in this room and that room. And she's like, I love this jacket. Oh, my God, I love this jacket. Oh, my God, this third jacket is gorgeous. And she has all of them in the fitting room. So I do the walk away. I'm like, okay, let me just, I mean, this. But she goes like, oh, my God, I'm so broke. I can't, I'm so broke. And I'm like, oh, what do you do? Commercial real estate. Oh, I sell $1 million properties, this and that.
And she's broke.
She's broke. Right. So she tries on one jacket. She's like, oh, I have to have this. I love it. Now, mind you, all of this took about 10 minutes. 10 minutes. All of a sudden, I start to walk away. She goes, you know what? I'll just take all three.
Ooh.
At this point, my jackets were $488. She dropped $1,500 in 10 minutes. I was like, all right, people. I have arrived. I am on Charles Street in Beacon Hill. And
you didn't miss Davis Square anymore.
Nope. Sorry, people. I crossed the river.
I'm just gonna like tell you, I'll give you my background really quickly.
Yes, please.
I've been in the music business my whole life. Okay, so that's it.
That's it.
I worked for labels. I managed bands, blah, blah, blah. We'll talk about it more because I want to segue into a rock star who you think is really well-dressed and styled and I think is like one of the greatest guitar players in the world, that being Gary Clark. Gary Clark Jr.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into Gary Clark Jr.?
So I went to the Exponential Music Festival let's call it 5-6 years ago in New Jersey, Camden, New Jersey, with some of my besties. And we were going to see the Alabama Shakes and Beck. And out walks this cool mother.
That was the lineup?
Yes.
Alabama Shakes, yes. Beck, and Gary Clark Jr.?
Gary Clark Jr. opened for Alabama Shakes, and Alabama Shakes opened for Beck. Now, I appreciate Beck. It didn't make sense to me based on the other two.
Yeah,
like, it just was a weird transition. But he comes out, and he just starts to go on that riff with his guitar. And, man, it was sexy. It was nasty. It was just badass, you know? And I was in the middle of a conversation, and I was like, oh, my God, guys, I got to go. And I just left my whole crew, and I just razor-focused on this guy. And he was just so incredibly prolific to me. I mean, this is a guy, to me, he's like one part Jimi Hendrix, one part Marvin Gaye, one part Prince, his falsetto, his like range of voice, but his style, all of it. Like, in order to be a band or a musician, you have to have all of those pieces. It's like from top to bottom, you got to live the part. And he, to me, in that moment, I was like, this guy is the best current musician out there.
You know, for people that don't know Gary Clark, I'm going to give you a little bit of background on him. He was actually playing in clubs in Austin where he grew up when he was 13 years old. Amazing. He started going to clubs. He used to sneak out of the house, and his parents got hip to him, and they supported him too, because I watched an interview with his parents, and they knew he was something. And he got his big break when Doyle Bramhall II, who toured with Roger Waters and Eric Clapton, told him to expect an invite to the 2010 Crossroads Festival, which Eric Clapton put on, like he did four or five of them, to raise money for his alcohol recovery place in Antigua. And he told him that Clapton was going to call him, and Clapton did call and invite him, and he went and played. And I had the same reaction when I was watching the Crossroads Festival, not live, but on TV or whatever, because it was broadcast somewhere. And I saw Gary Clark, and I'm like, who the hell is this guy?
Yeah.
You know, but I'm going to go so far to say now that along with Derek Trucks, I'd say that, you know, those are my two favorite younger guitar gods.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I love Jeff Beck and Brian May and Jimi Hendrix and all them. But if you go down to the current day, Gary Clark and Robert Randolph, too, I really like.
Derek Trucks.
I know you like Tedeschi Trucks.
I love Derek Trucks and Susan Tedeschi and the Tedeschi Trucks Band. I've seen them live. I saw the last concert I saw in 2019 was Tedeschi Trucks Band at the Orpheum. It was awesome.
It's funny because Doyle Bramhall II and Derek Trucks play together a lot. They both were in Clapton's band, and they play on each other's records. And Doyle is the one that, who's also from Austin, turned on Clapton to Gary Clark Jr. It's the connections.
And
all
I mean, so I've seen him now at least three or four times. And my last time I saw him was at the House of Blues. And that was his.
In Boston?
In Boston, absolutely. On Lansdowne. And that was This Land.
Album. This Land. Now, that's a whole nother conversation because that's one heavy tune. But
well,
he wrote it about his race.
The tune is
the album is This Land. The song This Land is about his racist neighbor.
Yeah. Racist neighbor. I mean, it's, you feel it. You feel his pain. You feel his anger. I mean, it's a very angry song.
Oh, yeah. It's, it's
rightfully so. Let's just speak of the fact that he has every right.
He references Trump in the first actual line of the song and about how racism escalated because you wrote it around 2016.
And so, but the album itself is really good. So if you guys haven't listened to it, you need to go out and get it and or download it, whatever. I mean, what was really impressive to me is that when I bought my tickets for the House of Blues show, and they weren't cheap. I mean, I think I spent, you know, I actually it wasn't too bad, but now his tickets go for like $250. Okay, like I was gonna try to see him. He opened up for the Rolling Stones.
Yes, that makes sense.
In 2019.
That makes a lot of sense. Keith probably loves
lost
him.
These last couple of years. Who does?
Keith Richards probably loves him.
Of course, as they should.
Like Clapton does. Clapton says he has the best flow of any guitar player since Jimi Hendrix. He's quoted as saying
absolutely. And just to kind of circle back to what you were saying, like, to me, the top guitarists would be Gary Clark, followed by Derek Trucks, and gosh, they're probably one, you know, right there on number one. And I'm a big fan of Luther Dickinson, too.
Of course you are.
Oh, he's sexy. I just wanted to also just say, I mean, I'm sure Gary Clark Jr. has a stylist and has been working with a stylist, but he's married to a woman I think you
Nicole Trofino. Trofino, yeah. Did I say it right?
I think so.
Beautiful
gorgeous
model.
Gorgeous Italian model. But his sense of style, again.
They have three kids, too.
They have three beautiful children, very young. They're all under the age of five at this point. And he took home some serious Grammys. Recently.
Yeah, he's big now. I mean, a couple of years ago, most people didn't know who he was. But now he's, now that Cibolline Ceriano knows him, everyone knows him.
Well, let's hope.
You're spreading the good word.
I want to spread any love I can
shout
out to him.
So we're going to do this every episode. We're going to cover all of these beautiful things we covered. Fashion, film, food, and music. How can you go wrong?
Right? The greatest loves in life. As far as I'm concerned.
Seems to me. S-E-A-M-S to me. Cibolline came up with that name.
Yeah.
I can't take credit for that.
Well, it was my blog that I did many moons ago, and I thought it was pretty clever. So I was like, let's keep this going.
So we even have an email now. So if you want to, like, send us questions, comments, whatever.
Seems to me.
CS@gmail.com.
Okay. There we go. That's our
I think
email.
We made it through our first show.
Holy cow. This is so much fun. I get to talk about my, like, things I like.
We get
I
to
like.
Talk. Period.
Oh, man.
Well, thanks for listening.
Thanks for doing this. Let's keep doing this.
We're going to keep doing it.
All right.